I have a bit of a daunting task ahead of me to tell the story of the first Christian missionaries to the Dakota or the Sioux Indians. Their names were Samuel Pond, in fact, Samuel William Pond, and his brother Gideon Hollister Pond. Now, the Pond family was of English Puritan ancestry. The first record of the Ponds in America is found in 1630. Edward Pond, the grandfather of Samuel and Gideon, married a sister of the Reverend Adoniram Judson Sr. and then settled in New Preston, Connecticut, which is where the two future missionaries were born, their father being Edward Pond and their mother, the former Sarah Hollister. Samuel Pond was born on, I would say, in April of 1808, and then his brother, Gideon, was born 2 years later, June 30th, 1810. The two were the fifth and the sixth of nine children in the family. In 1812, the Pond family moved to the wilds of eastern New York, settling on the western slope of the Catskill Mountains. And after 5 years, they returned to Litchfield County, again in Connecticut. Now, when he was 12 years old, Samuel went back to New York to live with an uncle, New York State this would be, but the uncle was killed within the year. Now after this, Samuel then again returned home, and he was apprenticed to a Captain Evitts Moody, who had a farm, and he had a cloth dressing business as well. Now Samuel didn't care for the cloth dressing business, kept him indoors too much, but he loved farming. And as you'll see, the Lord was preparing this young man with these farming skills that would be used of the Lord in his missionary work ahead, and preparing him in many other ways as well. Samuel, as a boy, loved to be out and about in the woods, and of course, this too was preparing him for the arduous life ahead as a missionary to the Dakota Indians. And it was the same way with Gideon, loved to be out and about. They were sturdy boys, and they were being trained for the rugged pioneer missionary work ahead of them. Now, Samuel was with Captain Moody then for 7 years, during which time he also attended school in a nearby village during the winter months, and he became an accomplished scholar in every subject taught in the school, as well as being a voracious reader of books of all sorts of subjects. After his time farming, Samuel then commenced teaching school in the village of Washington, and he was a very good and popular teacher. But again, this was valuable training for a man who would be a pioneer missionary and a preacher, as well as a teacher of many things, certainly spiritual, that was their focus, but also things having to do with the practical side of life. And this to the wild Dakota Indians. At a young age, Gideon was apprenticed to a carpenter, and he remained with him for quite some time. Now, his work included not just what you might call finished carpentry, but cutting down and hewing trees and framing hardwood timbers. And some of these were very massive, which were used for building barns. So again, these young men were being prepared for the work that lay ahead of them. At 15 years of age, due to some temporary health problems, Gideon had to leave his carpentry work and go to live with his sister, Mrs. Jonathan Hine. He lived there till he was of age. Also, as to the early life of the Pond brothers and their preparation for the work ahead of them, Samuel's son wrote this: "They owed much to the character, example, and counsels of their noble mother, whose consistent walk and conversation in the midst of many hardships and discouragements were a constant inspiration to her children." Now, as they came of age, neither Pond was yet in Christ. They had been raised, though, in a Christian family, and amid the example of many relatives whose character were told, quote, clearly exemplified the power and the beauty of the Christian faith. How important this is, that we don't just preach Christ, but our lives show the effectual power of the Holy Spirit and the regeneration of sinners, the making of the new man. But again, at this time, they were far from Christ, especially Samuel, who was a very restless young man. He was strong of mind, he was independent, and he was very quick to ridicule anything that he didn't believe. Now, when Samuel was 25 and Gideon was 23, a genuine spiritual awakening took place in their town of Washington, Connecticut. The Spirit of the Lord swept a great many into the kingdom of Christ at that time. And for months, right during the busiest and most critical season of the year for this farming community, sunrise prayer services were packed to overflowing every morning. Samuel saw the quickening, effectual work of the Spirit in conversion and regeneration, and soon he felt the same power of God at work in his own heart. After going through a season of darkness and despair, the Spirit shined the light of the gospel into this young man's heart, soundly saving him and regenerating him. Gideon was also truly converted and born again through the preaching of the gospel. Now, from this point on, immediately the brothers were filled with an unquenchable, active, burning love and loyalty for Christ Jesus, as well as a love and a deep concern for lost souls. And so they very shortly began to turn their gaze toward the mission field, and their attention was turned westward. The two agreed that Samuel should go west. They thought probably to Missouri on a scouting trip of sorts, and that once he found a promising mission field, then he would send for Gideon, if they both decided on the field. Now, Samuel began his travels in March of 1833 with just a small amount of money he had saved up working. They had no support. Very few people knew what they were doing. They just set off to do it. He went from New Haven to New York by boat, then to the border of New Jersey, and from there by stage through the hill country of Pennsylvania to Pittsburgh. From Pittsburgh, he took passage on a boat for St. Louis, traveling on reduced fare by being a deck passenger only, and working to load wood at various stops. But he didn't end up at St. Louis. On this trip, he contracted cholera, which at that time was very common along the western rivers, and it was very often fatal. Samuel's case was a very severe one, and he nearly died. Well, he finally ended up at Galena, Illinois, a small town, recently born, just down the road, a piece from here, maybe an hour from here. And Galena is, by the way, very often mentioned in the early accounts of circuit-riding pastors who came into the area. And, of course, that was at a little bit later date, though I say early accounts later than this. Now, Samuel remained in Galena until spring. He lived with a Mr. Jones, a printer. Well, now this man died of cholera. During his stay there in Galena, Samuel was active in Sunday school work, and he also cared for cholera victims. And he made friends with a Reverend Artis Kent, who was a pioneer minister in Galena, and they remained friends for life. Next, Samuel traveled to Mineral Point, Wisconsin. These are very familiar names for us because they're just, as I say, down the road. Also to Gratiot's Grove, Wisconsin, now called Gratiot, which is very close to here. He was looking for a school to teach in, to tide him over until they decide on a mission field because, as I say, there was no support or anything. They used their own money and they worked to raise the funds they needed, but he found no openings in any schools. He had trouble enough finding schools in that time in our state. Now, in June of 1833, he traveled to the young town of Chicago through mostly uninhabited land, went through just south of here to Chicago, and he traveled with Reverend Kent, and this land was, as I say, mostly uninhabited except for Indians. At this time, he saw a small village with a few hundred Indians, and then on the return trip, he ran across some Winnebago Indians as well. During this same year of 1833, he suffered a second attack of cholera. Again, it was a very severe attack. But in all this sickness and discouragement, he never wavered in his determination to take the gospel to the heathen. But he still didn't know where. And to who? He had no leading as to the Lord's will with regard to who he should take the gospel to. Now, he's back in Galena, and he visited a small store which sold liquor. Now, his mission in that was to exhort the owner to find a more honorable and proper way of making a living. But it turned out, of course, the Lord was at work. This man had information about the Dakota Indians, having traveled through their territory. Now, as soon as Samuel heard of what were called the warlike and wild Dakotas, His thoughts and prayers were full of the possibility of he and his brother going to those very people, making their mission field, those very Indians, the people spread out from the Midwest all the way to the Rockies eventually. Now, the Dakotas originally were in Wisconsin too, but they were pushed out by the Ojibwe because the Ojibwe got guns first, probably from the French. Dakotas are the same as the Sioux. They're known as the Sioux. They call themselves the Dakota. Some tribes call themselves the Lakota. There's other names as well. And so it was, though, that Samuel wrote to Gideon, and he invited him to join him in the early spring of 1834 in order to head to Dakota country. His Galena friend, Reverend Kent, was dead set against the plan. He said it's a wild scheme. He said he would never support it. But again, Samuel would not be moved away from his decision that he had made to go to the Dakota with the gospel of Christ. I want to read, I have a number of excerpts from letters and journals. I think it's good to read them. We have here a letter from Samuel, which he sent from Galena to Gideon. Gideon, of course, is still back east. A letter dated October 1833, speaking of Galena, Illinois. Now, the closer you get to the river, you have the French influence. The Jesuit priests and others came in, and then going with the fur trappers, the French fur trappers coming down these rivers. And Galena was very Roman Catholic at the time. He says this, Samuel to Gideon, "This is one of the strongholds of the Prince of Darkness. It has appeared to me during the past summer like the gates of hell, for it has been very unhealthy, and of the multitudes who have died here, I have not known one who has appeared to die in the Lord. I believe the church consists of about 17 members, yet I fear they exert but little influence on the world around them. Drunkenness prevails to a great extent, even among the most influential men. Gambling houses are openly kept in different parts of the village. Swearing is common even among children. Indeed, wickedness prevails in every form. The first white inhabitants of this part of the country came about 7 years ago. There are many Catholics here, but they have no priest. He died last summer, and I hope his place will never be filled. That religion is worse than no religion. Thus, you will see there is a great room for doing good here. I think that a person who comes in this country to do good ought to be willing to wait patiently for years, although he may see no fruit of his labor." Where others saw just darkness, Samuel Pond saw a chance to spread the light of the gospel. And as you will see, it's well that the Ponds were willing to wait patiently for years to see fruit from their arduous, continuous, and at times very dangerous labor among the Dakota, the proud, hard-hearted, cruel Dakota, who were so steeped in superstition and in such bondage to Satan, the father of lies and a murderer from the beginning. In another letter to younger brother Gideon, this one's dated December 3rd, 1833, Samuel unfolded his Dakota mission project more in detail. Let me read some excerpts from that letter. "Soon after my arrival here and becoming acquainted with the conditions of the surrounding Indians, my interest was excited on behalf of the Sioux, a large nation west of the Mississippi. I resolved to remain here until your arrival and then go up to the Fort of St. Peter's, which is located or situated on the St. Peter's River near the Mississippi. There is a body of Sioux Indians located near there. From them, we could learn the language, which is spoken by a vast number of Indians scattered over a large extent of the country. These Indians are visited only by traders in fur, nearly as ignorant as themselves, and are the most savage and warlike of all the northwestern Indians. I have obtained much information respecting these Indians since I came, and if I had an opportunity of conversing with you, I think I could easily convince you of the importance of doing something speedily for the Sioux. I know that difficulties attend the undertaking, but I believe they are not insurmountable. If God is with us, it will be enough. Pray that we may not undertake to go in our own strength." Again, reading excerpts of that letter. Now, to say, as Samuel did, that the Pond brothers had a few difficulties to overcome in taking the gospel to the Dakota is an understatement. But it wasn't uttered in foolishness or recklessness, but in faith and zeal. As to difficulties, they were numerous. Let me name just a few. They didn't know the Dakota language, and it was a very complex and difficult one. They had no permission from the Dakota to come into their territory. They had no permission from the federal government to take up residence among the Dakota in Indian country. The federal government was trying to protect the rights of everyone and keep some sort of a relationship with the Indians. And they had no permission to go into Indian territory. They had no financial support. They had no sending church. They had no missionary society behind them. Very few people even knew of their plans. The people they had targeted for the gospel, their gospel labors were cruel. They were extremely warlike. They were constantly at war with their hereditary enemies, the Ojibwe, also called the Chippewa. There are Chippewa in Wisconsin today. There's a reservation up north, several reservations of Chippewa here in Wisconsin. It was then a territory. These two Indian nations, the Ojibwe and the Dakota, delighted in killing each other, including killing their women and children, perhaps especially killing the women and children, even torturing, including burning alive women and children. These are the people they're taking the gospel to. The Dakota were also at that time primarily hunters, fishers, and trappers. They had villages, but they were often gone, necessarily so, on hunting trips and fishing trips and trapping expeditions. They were also very much under the influence of their medicine men and the sorcerers among them, and they delighted in various heathen rituals, especially the scalp dance. Now, another letter from Samuel to Gideon at this time tells of the climate in this part of the Midwest, which you all know everything about. You live it, where it's often hot, very hot and humid, and the winters can be very long and at times intensely cold and often with much snow and wind. Samuel tells his brother what clothing to bring with him and gives other practical instruction. And then he writes this: "Perhaps you look upon my scheme as visionary, but I cannot think of it so. You say that although someone ought to go, we are not the ones. But why not we? Cannot we learn the Indian language as well as others? Who are under greater obligations and have greater reason to deny themselves and take up the cross and follow Christ than you and I? You may object that you are not qualified for a missionary, but what is wanting? It is not natural talents. It is true God hath withheld from us those brilliant talents which he has bestowed on some, but what then? We can tell our fellow sinners that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, and whosoever believeth on him should not perish, but have eternal life. I assure you, there is a wide field of usefulness in this place. There is much to be done here. The harvest is great and the laborers few. I want you to seek direction from God. Let us set apart a particular time of day in which to seek heavenly wisdom, that we may be enabled to choose that course of conduct by which God will be most glorified and the most good done to our fellow men. Our usefulness and happiness depend upon our living near to God, for you well know that God alone can make us useful and happy. If we wish to grow in grace, we must read the Bible much and pray much, and not only read and pray, but act." Now, at this time, Samuel was 26, and Gideon, who was soon convicted by the Lord and convinced to join Samuel, and shortly did, was 24. The record shows they were both 6 feet tall, and it was said stalwart, sinewy, alert, and genial. The two of them then, once reunited, started up the Mississippi River on a steamer appropriately called the Warrior. They slept on the deck. They ate the simplest and plainest of foods, cheapest then of foods, and they helped load and unload cargo at various places to get their fare down. They saw their first Dakota Indians at Prairie du Chien, which again, it's just a short distance from here, really. At that time, it was a French fur trading post. They arrived upriver at Fort Snelling on May 6. This would be in Minnesota, on that side of the river, May 6, 1834. Now, Fort Snelling was, still is, located at the juncture of the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers, just south of the Twin Cities. Fort Snelling was on a small piece of ground gained by the U.S. government through a treaty with the Dakota. All other lands west of the Mississippi in what is now Minnesota were in Dakota hands. Well, the brothers Pond rented a room at Fort Snelling. Major Bliss, the commander of the fort, immediately demanded of them an explanation for their presence and their purpose for coming to Indian territory. They were also questioned by a Major Lawrence Taliaferro, the Indian agent at the fort. After giving Major Bliss their reason for coming to the territory, which was to do the most good we can for the Indians and preach the gospel to them, he granted them permission to stay, which was surprising. But again, the Lord was at work. And ever after, that major and his wife, as long as he was the commandant of that fort, and it did change a number of times during the Pond's ministry years, but him and his wife were the warmest of friends and were very avid supporters of the missionary labors of Samuel and Gideon. Now, one thing which the Lord used to the advantage of the Pond brothers' designs to stay, when really they weren't supposed to, was their farming know-how. Because the Indian agent mentioned that there was a band of Dakota, and this was very strange, not far from the fort, who suddenly wanted to learn how to plow and plant crops like the white man, because they were hoping to avoid the starving times which came when there was an especially hard, severe winter or a long summer drought, and it affected the Dakota's ability to live off of fish and game. Now, these particular Indians had heard of the white man's farming ways, and they, of course, were ahead of the rest of their people in asking to learn those ways. Well, of course, the Pond brothers immediately volunteered to spend some time teaching the Dakota how to plow with oxen and plant crops, discerning that this was the Lord at work, to give them a reason for being there. This, no doubt, provided cover for the commander of the fort and the Indian agent to allow the brothers to stay in the territory and even locate among the Dakota. We have a quote here from Samuel with regard to his time spent plowing, teaching plowing, and farming to Chief Big Thunder and his people. I think it gives some insight into the good Protestant understanding the brothers had of a right work ethic and the way to teach it. Samuel, right from the start, insisted that the Indians actually handle the plow. Well, they didn't know what they were doing, but he didn't just show them. He made them take hold of the plow, and he drove the oxen, and he taught them that way. He says, "I could have plowed as well, perhaps better, without their aid, but I promised to help them only on the condition that they would help themselves." Now, the Pond brothers, of course, now had their feet squarely in the door of Dakota country, and they just went through the door. They constructed a lean-to, and then they built a log cabin by Lake Calhoun. You can find it on a modern map. It's seven miles northwest of Fort Snelling. It's in downtown, basically downtown Minneapolis now. And this was the first home built by white men in Minnesota, or in that area, other than Fort Snelling. The Pond cabin was near a village of Dakotas. The band was led by, I won't attempt his Indian name, Mapaya Wakasta. Maybe I will attempt it. In English, translated, that would be Chief Cloud Man or Man of the Sky. So that was the leader of the band, the chief, and there was an Indian burying ground nearby, near the cabin on the lake, and it featured human hair and food scattered on all the graves. Part of what they did, according to their superstitions. Now, this cabin was 12 foot by 16 foot by 8 feet with a small cellar for storing potatoes. It was described and has been described not only as the first cabin built by white men, perhaps in Minnesota, really, as far as any kind of settlers, but the first schoolroom, the first house of Christian worship, and the first mission house among the Dakotas. Upon completion of the cabin, the brothers Pond had what they called a grand opening with scripture reading, prayer, and a meal of flour and water. For the next year and a half, they lived mostly on pork, flour, occasional fish, and some venison when they had time to get it. Because immediately, they set themselves to learning the extremely difficult Dakota language, as well as immediately working to understand the Indians, to learn the Indian customs, the Indians' history, their habits, their ways, even how they thought, and seeking as much contact with them as possible. At the time, though, they cleared 4 acres, cleared all the trees, and pulled stumps and everything else with the oxen and cleared it for tilling. And then once they cleared it, they planted it with food crops using a plow and a yoke of oxen they had obtained. This was a matter of survival for them. They had to eat. As of this time, they still received no missionary support from any source. In fact, they would labor on without the support of anyone, really, certainly any missionary society or organization, until 1838. Now, at this time, we have a letter written by the Ponds, the two of them, and in it, it's a long letter, they address various friends and family back home. I just want you to hear some excerpts of what was written to their mother. Again, excerpts. Dear Mother, alas, as far as I know, the glad tidings of salvation never reached the ears of a Dakota. Yet I cannot but hope that some will be gathered into the fold of Christ, even among this wild and savage nation. Since I first thought of coming here among the Sioux, I have at times felt much anxiety, but dared not do otherwise than come. Sometimes I have been ready to faint, but when my foot slipped, then the Lord held me up. I can have no doubt that the Lord has brought us here, and he has prepared the way before us in a very remarkable manner. Pray for us, that we may render to him again according to his benefits toward us, and I trust you will pray for the heathen around us. If we consider only their temporal condition, they are most miserable. The men are esteemed honorable in proportion to the number of human beings they have destroyed, for each of whom they wear a feather in their heads. There has been war this summer between the Chippewa, again that's the Ojibwe, and the Sioux, again that's also the Dakota. Their wars are engaged in that they may have a chance to murder a man, woman, or child and wear another feather. Pray for us that we may have grateful hearts and be faithful unto death. The Bible tells us in all things we're to pray with thanksgiving. And these two young men are a wonderful example to us. You notice all through their letters constantly the gratitude they have to the Lord for what great things he had done for them. Now, I would mention here, too, I think this is interesting. Every letter the Ponds sent home or received cost 25 cents. When I was a boy, letters were far less expensive to send. And the dollar, of course, was worth less. And I think I do remember 5-cent stamps. I think I do. But I know it was far less than 25 cents. So this was a big financial commitment to send a letter, even. These are some of the hardships they face, some of the obstacles they face. And it is a hardship because you want to hear from the people at home. You want to be able to write to them. But I want to return to the subject of the Dakota language. The Pond brothers felt very strongly that to be used of the Lord and to do the most good for the Dakotas, they must learn the Dakota or Sioux language as soon as possible and speak it like a Dakota. Be as fluent as possible. Understand this very difficult and complex language, which at the time had never been put into writing, not one letter or syllable. There was no Dakota alphabet. There was no written form of Dakota. Samuel and Gideon, with their characteristic determination, plunged into learning this language in an amazingly short time. Not that they did it overnight, but given its complexity, in an amazingly short time, soon became even conversant and even proficient in the language. But they were always laboring to be as flawless as possible. Now, this is what's remarkable. Over time, they not only were fluent, learned and were fluent in Dakota, but also Hebrew, Greek, French, and Samuel also German. Now, the brothers next, with much labor and ingenuity, created, once they knew the language, they created a Dakota alphabet. And when you read how they did this, it's very interesting. It took much ingenuity. And they constructed, with that alphabet, a Dakota written language, and that stood the test of time. In fact, it was the basis of the Grammar and Dictionary of the Dakota Language, published in 1852 by the Smithsonian Institute. So these two young men, never gone to any institute of higher education, did all of this. Very soon after the Ponds created the alphabet and the written language of the Dakota, an Indian man requested that he be taught to read like the white man. But he wanted to learn in his own language. Well, they had his own language now in writing. His name was Walking Bell Ringer, would be the English translation. From that time on, the Ponds began to teach all Dakota who were willing to learn their language in the written form, teaching them to read, of course, wanting them to read so they could read the Bible. And the Pons began to produce many, many works in the Dakota language. I'll mention a few of those later. Now, in the highest missionary tradition, the Pond brothers labored to learn and become fluent in the Dakota language, but also they were determined to know everything Dakota, you might say, everything about the Dakota and understand it, their customs, their habits, their way of thinking even, their reasoning, their way of life, their history, everything. And it was their goal to learn to not only talk like a Dakota, but to be able to live like one, as rugged as that was. Live like one, I say, with regard to living conditions, diet, and so forth, not in certain other ways. And the way they taught themselves this was by staying days on end with the Dakota, including going on hunting expeditions with the Dakota. And over the years, during their labors among these Indians, Samuel and Gideon faced death many times, not just on these hunting trips. They faced death by winter storms. I'll mention some of the ways they faced death from the weather and from the cold, but also from the Ojibwe, the enemies of the Dakota, by certain treacherous Dakota who were not happy about these two white men, so determined, so courageous, so tenacious, preaching Christ among the Dakota. They faced starvation many times and also death by wild animals. That first winter, the Ponds passed in Dakota country, 1834 to 1835, was a very, very severe one, even for Minnesota. And they survived on pork and flour, a little venison from time to time, and they had stored up a few potatoes. Also, they did some trapping, including of the many wolves which ran in packs. Now, it was around this time that the Dakota, who had had now much interaction with the Ponds, good and bad, some trying to intimidate them and put them to flight, others more friendly relations. They had observed their ways. At this time, they gave the brothers Dakota, or Sioux names, by which they were ever after known by the Dakota. Samuel, they named, let me attempt the word, or the name in Dakota, Wamdidota, which means red eagle. Gideon, they called Matohota, and that means grizzly bear. Now remember, the Dakota names were meaningful. They looked at the person and they named them according to what they saw as to their character, their behavior, their mettle in this case. And so they named Samuel Red Eagle, and Gideon was Grizzly Bear. I want to just share some excerpts from a February 1835 letter home from Gideon. Samuel has gone to the fort to spend the Sabbath. That would be 7 miles away. Thursday, I go to attend prayer meeting. Perhaps you will be surprised that there should be prayer meetings at the garrison. I am, and can but say, what hath God wrought? I should say there was a revival of religion there, but there was none to revive, so I will rather say religion has just begun. Perhaps you have read before now that an officer came here last summer who is a professor of religion, and there is no risk in saying that he is an active Christian. His wife and daughter, too, are Christians. Last summer, when we went to the fort, we used to visit him and unite in prayers. And now there are about 15 who give good evidence of having passed from death unto life. Well, the officer was one Brigadier General Gustavus Loomis, who was a staunch Presbyterian and very strongly supportive of gospel ministry in general, and most particularly supportive of the Pond Brothers' work among the Dakotas. Now, at this time, there are so many characters in this story. I can only mention a few, and I can't even mention many. But at this time, the Ponds do mention for the first time a Lieutenant Ogden, who was a very wild young man when he came to be stationed at Fort Snelling, but he was soon converted to Christ and became a very strong supporter of the work of the Ponds among the Dakotas. Now, in May of 1835, the Ponds having now blazed a trail, word was starting to get back east about what they were doing, a Dr. Thomas S. Williamson and also an Alexander G. Huggins with their wives and children arrived to work among the Dakotas with the Ponds, reinforcements. Dr. Williamson had been a successful medical doctor in Ohio, but he was convicted that the Lord would have him go into missionary work. And when he was convicted, he cheerfully left his practice and he headed for Fort Snelling. He was drawn to that location by reports circulating of the Pond Brothers' pioneering work. This Williamson would have a very long, consistent, and useful life of hard labor among the Dakota. Huggins came to farm and to teach. Both had a difficult time learning the language, very difficult time learning the language, but the ponds were there, and they had put it into writing. The pioneer missionaries now had it in writing, and they labored much to teach others among the missionaries that would come the language, and so they were just invaluable in this too. They just had this gift from the Lord. Now, a second mission station was then established. This was on the Minnesota River at Lac Quay Parle. My apology to all people French, but that's the closest I can come. A Reverend J.D. Stevens, I think it was Jedediah, was his full first name, arrived soon with his family as well to do their part among the Dakota with, again, the ponds leading the way. The ponds giving strength and encouragement to everyone and teaching the language. Now, the Stevens family settled on Harriet Lake. I want to mention Cornelia Stevens, 16 years of age, that, of course, was the daughter of J.D. Stevens, Jedediah Stevens. Now, this girl was very bright, very witty, very gifted, said to be strikingly beautiful, quick at learning, fluent in French. And she immediately set about to learn Dakota. Why would I mention she's strikingly beautiful, along with all those other things? Because this young woman had everything. She could have lived in the lap of luxury. She could have had society at her feet. And she spent her life among the Indians. In fact, as you'll see, she spent 10 years among them. She taught the Dakota children, beginning with a Dakota spelling book, written by the ponds, and then using other books they translated and produced. She continued until her health was broken, and she went home, it was said, apparently to die. But she did not die. The Lord was not done with her yet. She ended up marrying a Swiss missionary, who was of Swiss extraction. And then, if I'm not mistaken, the two of them went to Canada, and she spent her life as a missionary with him there, and died relatively young in her 50s. But she was said to die with the joy and peace of the Lord and with much exhortation to her children to stay faithful to the Savior. Now, what Samuel Pond's son, who wrote a book, in fact, I have the book here, on the missionary labors of his father and his uncle, what he later wrote of the missionary women of the Dakota Mission certainly, I think, pertained to a great many pioneer missionary women in various places around the globe at various times. It required no small degree of self-denial for delicately nurtured women, accustomed to the comforts of civilized life. He's saying, relatively speaking, delicately nurtured compared to what they went to. Accustomed to the comforts of civilized life and the advantages of cultured society, to abandon them all for a home in an Indian village at that time, and nothing but the heroic devotion and Christian fortitude which characterized these noble women among the early missionaries could have made the life endurable. Their chosen life was one of danger as well as toil, and it is not surprising that several of the number, that is, among the Dakota Mission, did not live beyond comparative youth. There was a high mortality rate among Christian missionary women, and we ought never to forget their sacrifice and service. But now a Presbyterian church was organized at Fort Snelling, and a company room was used for the services. You can go there yet, and you can see that room. Four ruling elders were chosen, Major Loomis and H.H. Sibley, I believe he's an Indian agent, Samuel Pond and Alexander Huggins, also a missionary. Lieutenant Ogden had recently married the daughter of Major Loomis, and he was also part of the church. One of the soldiers involved that early time in that early church there in Minnesota wrote, "The communion was administered for the first time in Minnesota to 21 persons of European extraction, composed of officers and soldiers of the garrison, those engaged in the fur trade, and the mission families." Now, the harvest of corn and potatoes the ponds brought in that year was very, very abundant. It was a good one. But they turned over much of that harvest, along with a cow they had, to be used for all the missionaries. And for this, they neither asked nor received any sort of remuneration, and they continued at this time to receive no support, neither did they ask for any at this time. In the late fall of 1835, Samuel Pond went on a midwinter, very cold deer hunting trip, 60 miles up the Mississippi River with 50 Dakota and their families, as well as their dogs, always dogs, many, many dogs. It was very, very noisy around an Indian village at night between the dogs and sometimes the scalp dance and all the incantations of the medicine men and so on and so forth. And if someone had died, then there was all the wailing and the screeching and the screaming. It wasn't an easy life. And with dogs, there were fleas and all manner of various vermin around. But they went. Samuel went on this trip for the purpose of learning to be more fluent in the Dakota language and also to learn more of their customs and, of course, to share the gospel. He would take a rifle, his flint and steel, a blanket, a knife, and his Bible. And that was it. In a letter, Samuel explained, "I go with the Indians because I learn the language much faster." Well, they knew the language, but they wanted to be so very fluent. "When I am with them and do not speak English, missionaries do not think it their duty to live with the Indians in order to learn the language." He meant some missionaries. "Though I believe the missionaries to the Pawnee do. It is my duty to do so. It is disagreeable living with them, but the Lord is with me. In whatever circumstances we are in, while in him confiding, we cannot but rejoice." About a month with the Dakota on that particular trip, then Samuel separated from them and he headed back to the cabin alone. Well, this was a very dangerous trip for this man to make, this white man, at that time of year, and the Indians felt he would never make it back alive, so the chief sent an Indian man after Samuel to be his guide. Catch up to him, make sure he gets back to his cabin safely. The only problem was, the Indian soon returned, saying the white man took such long strides and moved so fast that he finally gave up trying to catch him. Now, Samuel did arrive home safely, though not easily and not without much hardship and danger. He arrived safely home only to find in his absence that Gideon had nearly drowned. Now, I can't share everything with you that these Ponds went through and experienced, but I can share some of their near brushes with death as they labored to win converts for Christ among the Indians. As Gideon was running across the lake one day on the ice to feed some cattle the Ponds kept on the other side, he broke through a thin spot in the ice. He caught himself on the ice with his arms, and he's in this frigid water. He only survived by keeping his head and breaking the thin ice ahead of him, keep going forward until he came to solid ice, and then only by the grace of God, much grace of God, he pulled himself up on the ice, and he was able to make it back to his cabin, clothes thoroughly stiff and frozen by then. During their time among the Dakotas, the Pond brothers made so many perilous journeys, including during the winter. I want to give you another example. In the winter of 1835, Dr. Williamson wrote to the Ponds, urging one of them to remove to the Williamson missionary station at Lac Qui Parle for a time and aid him in learning, further learning, the language of the Dakota and to give a hand up there. Everyone was always leaning on the Ponds. They were the rocks of the mission. Dr. Williamson was not near so quick to learn this difficult language as the Pond brothers. Well, of course, the Pond brothers, they decided one of them should go and talk things over with Williamson before making a decision. Samuel, the oldest, left in February for a very long trip, many-day trip through the cold snows and wind. The only points of human habitation along the way were three trading posts. And Samuel wasn't familiar with the route, so he secured a Dakota guide named Mama. Strange name, I know, even for an Indian, but Ma. And the Dakota, other Dakota, warned him that this Mama was not very trustworthy. Well, they set off, because that's all he could get at the time, so he went. They were indomitable. They were going to go. Samuel was going to go, and he went. But due to unforeseen circumstances, these two, the Indian and Samuel Pond, were soon very short of food, and then food ran out altogether. It's quite a story, and we don't have time to tell the whole thing. The weather was, in a word, brutal. Samuel froze his face. At night, the two would, as was done in winter travel, build a fire, curl up, and wrap up in a blanket, Then they'd sleep until they were too cramped because they'd pull up their legs to try to stay warm and stay close to the fire. They'd sleep till they were too cramped, or the fire went down, they got cold. Then they'd build up the fire, sit up for a while, and then start the whole process over, and then be happy when the sun came up. Well, it turned out that the Indian guide had lied. He didn't know the way to Lac Qui Parle, and they were thoroughly, thoroughly lost. Well, next they got hit by a blizzard. It lasted 24 hours, and they could only see a few feet at a time. You've seen that sort of snow. They had no choice but to wrap up in their blankets and just wait for 24 hours. At this point, to make matters worse, Samuel came down with a very severe cold, and he became quite weak. At the same time, his Indian companion became very surly and threatening, trying constantly to pick a fight with Samuel, no doubt so that he could have an excuse to kill him, and Samuel thought, more than likely eat him. They had no food. So now there was no sleep possible, and they were lost. And this Indian was surly and murderous acting. Samuel decided not only does he have to be on guard against the Indian so he doesn't get any sleep, but he decides his only chance is to slip away from the Indian and set out on his own, which he did. And it's a long story. It's amazing what he went through, but he walked continuously and without any food for 3 more days straight, following the Minnesota River, not knowing where he was, but believing he's on the right track to follow the river. And when he was close to his end, he spotted a horse and a colt along the river. Well, this horse allowed him to catch her. And he managed to get on her back. Immediately and very swiftly, she took him straight to the missionary station. Well, it turned out the horse belonged to a Joseph Renville, a trader with quite a history, too, eventually in Christian missions, but we won't go into it. But he explained that that very morning, that horse had left his herd of 30 horses and run off. Very strange, just separated and run off. And Renville told Samuel that she was the only horse in the herd who would ever have allowed a stranger to catch and mount her. And she was the very horse that ran off and stood right in the path of the missionary. He couldn't miss her. Now, so Samuel's there, and it's decided that Gideon would spend some time there helping Dr. Williamson, it's 1836, at this mission station, helping him to learn the Dakota language and, of course, help him with his mission labor. So the summer of 1836, Gideon was there. Now he did all of that and helped with the missionary labors, but he worked sawing boards to build a mission house at Lac Qui Parle. He was building for the Williamson Station. It was said of Gideon, and this was true of Samuel as well, that he was, quote, never known to refuse any burden of toil or hardship, whether in the line of manual labor or personal exposure, which seemed to lie in his path. Now, during the winters of 1836 and 37 and 1837 and 38, Gideon translated portions of the New Testament to Dakota, even as he witnessed and worked among the Dakota amidst many frustrations and peril. At this time, a letter from Gideon includes this. Some of the boys, that would be the little Dakota boys, here have learned to read and write their own language very well, and very often asked to be taught God's word, saying they will follow it. Others are growing up in ignorance, as did their fathers and mothers, who perhaps fear they will be taught another religion than their own and do not bring them to be taught by the missionaries. A number of the men have learned to read and write also, but as yet we have no books. A few are anxious to learn what is in the Bible. In April 1836, Samuel Pond left on a journey back east to his home for a short stay to further his theological studies, also learn Greek, the better to work among the Dakota. He also, while he was home, taught school a bit to pick up money to live on. And also to help with the work back among the Dakota. In March of 1837, Samuel was ordained a missionary of the Congregational Church. He then headed right back to Dakota country to join his brother. In Prairie du Chien, he took passage on a boat upriver. It was piloted by a Mr. Hudson. That will sound familiar to Wisconsinites because Hudson, Wisconsin, is named for that very man. He, being Samuel, reached Lake Calhoun, May 1837. I want to read some excerpts from a letter to his mother, dated after he got back. This is Samuel Pond. I am getting along tolerably well.
I live about a mile from the Indian village and go there almost every day. I do not think there are any Christians among the Sioux. They were very slow to say this is a Christian. They wanted to see the fruits of regeneration. But some of them are beginning to gain the knowledge of God which is necessary to their conversion. Last night, the Indian whom I first taught to read stayed with me. After I had prayed, he remarked that although he did not know how to pray, he would try. He then knelt down and prayed with a fluency and propriety seldom surpassed by Christians who have had the advantage of a Christian education. But still, I do not think he is a Christian. And I warned him against trusting in his prayers and thinking he could please God without a new heart. If I could see him a Christian, I would feel 1,000 times repaid for coming here. I have preached occasionally this summer to white people. Today, some officers with their wives came here from the fort, and I preached to about a dozen from the 21st verse of the 20th chapter of Acts. Although God has not given me any souls as seals of my ministry among the Indians, yet his continued goodness to me in giving me health and favor with the Indians, in supplying my temporal wants, and enabling me to learn the language, encourages me to hope that I shall yet see some of the Indians believing on Christ. But let it be as it will be. I know in whom I have believed. The Lord is my shield and will be my exceeding great reward. I want you to remember that I have to be continually engaged or accomplish nothing. Now, the Indian who prayed was walking bell ringer, and he never did become a Christian. Prayed eloquently, but he never became a Christian. Eventually, he was employed by the whiskey sellers that moved into what is now the St. Paul area, and he was employed by them to seduce other Indians to exchange what they had, various way furs and so forth, for liquor. And he soon perished from the effects of liquor. Now, during the year 1837, the Dakota ceded all of their land east of the Mississippi, not west, but they still had some land claims in Wisconsin and what we call Wisconsin now, the state of Wisconsin. They ceded these to the USA, to the United States of America, in exchange for substantial financial annuities for 20 years. They took that money, many of them, and bought whiskey with it. Whiskey dealers eventually established, as I said, a base where St. Paul is now. But I also think we should mention that a large proportion of the actual pioneers who eventually came into Minnesota were said to be, quote, distinctly religious men. Using the terminology of that day, they were Christians. Now, in October of 1837, Samuel Pond went with a very large band of Dakota on a fall hunting trip, and they ventured into Ojibwe country. Now, this is very dangerous going. On these hunts, especially in the summer, the missionary often heard the sounds of the scalp dance far into the night. The dance was indulged in immediately after scalps were taken, but also constantly as they celebrated, setting these up on poles and danced around them in this fiendish dance. And as I mentioned earlier, of course, there were the medicine men and the sorcerers with their incantations and so on and so forth. And the Ponds on these trips did not spare in confronting the medicine men and all of the Dakota when it came to their heathenish practices, witnessing for the one true God and the only way of salvation. And during these hunts, as I said, they carried very little, just the essentials that they needed to survive. In January, after the hunt, Samuel journeyed back to Lake Harriet, accompanied by Walking Bell Ringer. Now, it had been a very, very warm midwinter thaw. We get those sometimes. And it caused them to have to wade through melting snow, water, with, you've seen it, snow in it, very frigid. At times, they were up to their knees for a great long time, and they were soaked to the skin in the frigid water. Well, at one point, Samuel's Indian companion just stopped and broke into gales of laughter. And when the missionary inquired as to the cause of such an outbreak, his Indian companion replied, "I was thinking what a fool you are to be wading through melting snow when you might be in a comfortable home with plenty of good food." Of this incident, Pond Samuel later wrote, "Many a white man would no doubt have called me a fool as well, but not many would have laughed so heartily while standing in cold water up to their knees themselves." Now, on November 1st, 1837, Gideon married Sarah Poage, I hope I pronounced her name right, the sister of Reverend Williamson. The ceremony was performed by Reverend Stephen Riggs, who with his wife Mary had shortly before come to join the Dakota mission started by the Ponds. Reverend Riggs and his wife would labor for 40 years among the Sioux or the Dakota and come very, very close to losing their life during the Dakota Uprising in 1862. The Riggs, by the way, eventually in their old age settled over here in Beloit, Wisconsin. Gideon's wife Sarah was said to be, quote, a woman of modest, unassuming character, but most self-denying and exemplary in her Christian life, much beloved by all who knew her. Now, in the spring of 1838, as we just hopscotch our way through this, there's so much we could talk about and keep in mind constantly. The Ponds are witnessing for Christ and teaching and witnessing and preaching to the Indians. But in 1838, the spring in April, to be precise, Gideon Pond went on one of the Indians' hunting trips. Of course, this was in the spring, a spring hunting trip, so it was necessary to wade through many cold, flooded creeks, sometimes shoulder high. No game taken the first day. They had this saying, they lay down empty. They lay down empty, in fact, on the banks of the Chippewa River. Of course, the Chippewa River, we have it right here in Wisconsin. During the hunt, the Indians and the missionary dined on whatever was available. Turtles, geese, ducks, muskrat, groundnuts, fish, including dead ones on the riverbank. The Indians would smell them and say, this is good to eat. And so the missionary ate dead fish picked up along the riverbank. Now, at one point, six of the Indian family stayed camped in a particular place while Gideon and the rest of the men hunted another area. One of their number went back to that main encampment where the six Indian families were, ran back on errand, and he returned with the news that the Ojibwe had slaughtered the men, the women, and the children of the Dakota in that camp, scalping and mutilating them. They went back and they buried their dead, and the Indians headed back to their permanent encampment. Gideon Pond traveled a good distance back to, again, Lac de Parle, where he was still laboring for a time with Mr. Williamson, teaching him Dakota, ministering to the Indians there. Immediately after the massacre by the Ojibwe or Chippewa, the Dakotas began planning their revenge, and it would come 2 years later. Now, it's important to note that through all their labors among the Dakota, I just want to stress, they did much labor with regard to the Indians' temporal good, and they did much labor with regard to the mission stations that began. Of course, we've got two now, and there were more laboring, building, and lumbering, and so on and so forth. They were constantly preaching the gospel and teaching the doctrines of the Christian faith to any Dakota willing to listen, and some not so willing to listen. November of 1838, the Ponds had another brush with death, and we don't have the time to list all the brushes with death they had, but here's another particular one. Through no fault of their own, the brothers ended up in the Minnesota River. This is in November. It was just before it froze up. They were being ferried across the river by a Frenchman who mismanaged the canoe. Leave it to a Frenchman to mismanage things. But after getting themselves out of the river, they then walked 8 miles in soaking wet and then, of course, frozen clothing to their cabin on Lake Harriet. They had strong constitutions. Then a few days later, Gideon set off on a days-long journey back to Lac de Parle, traveling on foot through deep snow with the mercury below zero, all alone. Around this time, I don't have the exact date, Samuel traveled to a place called Traverse des Sioux to care for a Mr. Prescott. Word came that this man is ill. So, of course, the Ponds had by now learned some basic medical skills. Off he went. As soon as the call came, off he went to help. At this place, Samuel found the most degraded Indians he had ever seen, and the Canadian employee in charge of Mr. Prescott's trading store, the sick man was a trader, was even worse. Beyond all doubt, they all heard some strong preaching during the missionary stay. Now, after 2 months, Samuel left then Traverse des Sioux for Lac de Parle, and he was traveling with a chief called Eaglehead. And this is in the spring, and again, there were cold rains and sleet on their journey, and they reached the Chippewa River, and they found it badly flooded, and it was a cold and windy day. Well, Eaglehead suddenly decided, he's just too old to swim across
the flooded river to fetch a canoe on the other side to carry him and his wife and his son and, of course, Samuel safely back across the river. So into the frigid waters goes Samuel, swims across this flooded river, brings back the canoe, and on they go, and now it's snow falling, and, of course, Samuel's clothes soaking wet, and they complete their journey. Sometime after this, in a courtship of a number of months, Samuel Pond married a missionary lady, Miss Cordelia Eagleston, who was, as as Reverend Riggs wrote, quote, a noble woman, very quiet and retiring, very pleasant and truthful. No one who became acquainted with her could help admiring her character as a woman and a Christian. And she was a diligent worker for the Lord, and she worked through much hard times and hardships. A week after his wedding, Samuel Pond wrote home in a letter to a friend, my brother Gideon, you probably have learned, was married a little more than a year ago. I believe that we both have such wives as missionaries ought to have. I need not tell you that neither of us expected ever to be married when we came to this wild country. But through the good providence of God, without any exertions of our own, we have both obtained wives where we little expected to find them. In a letter to his mother about this time, Samuel wrote of his labors translating the scriptures into Dakota or Sioux, that is, working on getting the whole Bible translated. And then he went on to speak of other things. Of the scriptures, he wrote that every day it was possible, he spent time translating a chapter or two. But here are some other excerpts from that letter. I hold a meeting in Sioux on the Sabbath day. In other words, he was preaching in Sioux, but few attend. I have been here a long time and have not been the means of the conversion of one Indian. Yet I am not discouraged. It is my earnest desire and prayer to God that he would give me the souls of the heathen as seals of my ministry. Yet my eternal welfare does not depend upon it. This, I trust, is secured by the promise of God. I know in whom I have believed. I have great hope that I shall yet see many of the Indians converted. But faithful missionaries in different parts of the world have spent their lives without seeing any fruits of their labors. And what am I better than they? If they saw no good effects of their labors while on earth, they can now look back and see that, quote, their labors were not in vain in the Lord, quoting, of course, from the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians. You know, I think maybe I'll stop here and just let you get up and get something to drink. I've got a little ways to go.